Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm attorney Barry Vogel. Racial politics in America is the topic of this edition of Radio Curious. In our third visit with Harvard Law School professor Randall Kennedy, he is the author of The Persistence of the Color Line, Racial Politics and the Obama Presidency. Professor Kennedy and I visited by phone from his home in Massachusetts on October 28, 2011, and began our conversation when I asked him to describe the current role of race in American politics.
Race is still a potent and omnipresent force in American politics, particularly American electoral politics. That's why when you say Barack Obama, the first thing that comes to people's mind is first black president. And that's why his election was so momentous, because black people in the United States have been marginalized in every sphere of life, including electoral politics. There have only been two popularly elected black governors in all of American history. There have only been three popularly elected black senators. That's why the election of Barack Obama was such a big deal. And he still has to confront racial politics in a different way than any white president would have to confront such politics.
Can you define some of those ways?
To get elected, Barack Obama had to assuage the anxieties of non-black voters. He had to go out of his way to show that he is not an angry black man, that he is not racially resentful, that he is not seeking reparations. And he has had to bend over backwards to assuage those anxieties since he's become president. Give a couple of examples. When Joe Wilson shouted, "You lie," in a joint session of Congress in which the president was setting forth his proposals for health care reform, there was a lot of speculation as to whether race had played a role in the Representative Joe Wilson's egregious act of rudeness. There were some people who said, sure, race plays a role. It's not the only thing, but it's part of the story of the Joe Wilson outburst. For instance, President Jimmy Carter said, sure, race had something to do with this. When the question was put to Barack Obama, he didn't say anything about race. He said, listen, this guy has apologized to me. I accept the apology. Let's move forward. In other words, even though it seems to me quite clear that race had something to do with what Joe Wilson said, Barack Obama didn't want to go there because he understood it was an electoral loser for him, especially as a black politician. He's gone out of his way to avoid discussing racial issues expressly. And one of the reasons why he has gone out of his way to avoid such topics is because it's an electoral loser for him. He has to be on guard at every moment with respect to himself. He knows that if he says something or does something that looks like it is going to be especially favorable to black people, there will be detractors all over him asserting that he's engaging in racial nepotism, that he's engaging in racial favoritism.
Yet in the 2008 campaign, he addressed race directly at his speech at Independence Hall in Philadelphia.
Yeah, a couple things about that. Number one, on that occasion, he simply had to. He would never have given that speech in the absence of the controversy involving his relationship with Reverend Wright. There was this furor about his relationship with Reverend Wright, and he had to tampen down that controversy. That's why he gave that speech, A More Perfect Union. Second of all, again, because of his need to assuage the anxieties of non-blacks, that had a lot to do with the way in which he actually shaped that speech. Many people think that that speech was a wonderful speech. I think that it was a good speech for his political purposes, but there are many people who say that it was a deep speech that was really quite candid and revealing about race in America. I don't think that. Candidate Obama spoke a number of times about, you know, black people having experienced racial discrimination, having experienced enslavement, having experienced Jim Crow segregation. He is studiously non-accusatory. These things happen to black people. He never, you know, sort of names names. He never says, well, who is doing these things to black people? He never says anything, frankly, that will really grate against the sensibilities of white listeners. Now, some people are angry with him for taking that position. I'm not. He's an electoral politician and has to be keenly attentive to the discipline of electoral politics. After all, it's a majority white electorate, and, you know, he has to be attentive to that.
You talk about turning social stigma into political capital.
I think that he did turn social stigma into political capital. Barack Obama succeeded in making his blackness a plus. It wasn't a total plus. He still had to overcome his blackness. Fortunately, they were marginal, but there were still hundreds of thousands of people who, you know, would refuse to vote for any black person, and Barack Obama had to come to grips with that. But it's also the case that there were lots of people of all different racial backgrounds who were especially excited by the prospect of a black president. And in this way, Barack Obama's blackness helped him out. There was a special fervency, a special enthusiasm, at least in part because he was a black candidate. It was his blackness that gave his campaign the aura of a crusade for many people.
Well, let's move then on to his presidency, and there are a number of attributes there that I'd like to discuss. But before we get there, I'd like to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Professor Randall Kennedy from the Harvard Law School about his new book, The Persistence of the Color Line, Racial Politics and the Obama Presidency. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Let's talk about his appointment of Justice Sotomayor to the Supreme Court and the racial elements involved in that appointment.
Well, there were a variety of racial elements. I mean, after all, it was an historic appointment. She became the first Latino justice. The president sort of obliquely referred to that. I mean, it was so obvious that he didn't have to refer to it expressly. He referred to it obliquely, but he didn't make a whole lot about it, you know, in a sort of open, obvious way. That was a historic appointment. I'm sure that there were a lot of things that played into it. The president is a student of American history. I'm sure that he was attentive to the historical nature of that appointment. I'm sure, too, that he was aware that it might pay him some political benefit insofar as Latinos are an important part of the coalition that brought him to office. They will be an important part of the coalition that he will be depending upon for his reelection. And he did what, you know, lots of presidents have done in the past, used an appointment in a way that they hope will help them politically. Her nomination was controversial insofar as her racial politics became a subject of debate. She's a person who expressly stated that she was an affirmative action baby, that she credited affirmative action with having assisted her in the early parts of her academic career. But she wasn't apologetic about that at all. There were some people who suggested that that showed that she was somehow deficient. Of course, as I wrote in my book, that was an absurd and a ridiculous allegation. The fact of the matter is her record is fully as strong as the record of any of the other sitting justices.
Let's look at Obama's comment, as you say, by repeating the slogan that a judge's job is to interpret and not make law. You challenge that And I agree with your challenge that judges do make law.
Of course judges make law, and I was very critical of the president when he introduced Sonia Sotomayor. It seemed to me that it was a good appointment, but one of the things that clouded it for me was the way in which he introduced her. He said, well, here's Sonia Sotomayor. One of the reasons I chose her is because she's a person who suggests to me that as a judge, she will interpret the law, not make the law. Well, that slogan that judges merely interpret the law, don't make the law, is a slogan of the right wing in American politics and American law, and it's completely unrealistic. Judges at every level, sometimes they are merely carrying out orders from a legislature, but oftentimes they're not. At least that's not all they're doing. Legislation has many gray areas. Legislation has many holes in it, which judges fill in. So judges at every level are constantly making law, and that's especially true at the Supreme Court level, where they're interpreting a document that is very open textured, and the ideological beliefs of judges will necessarily play a role, a very large role, in the judgments they make. So I thought that the president on that one was really reinforcing a misleading portrait of what judges actually do.
I think the most profound example of judges making law is the Brown versus Board of Education on the desegregation case, overruling Plessy versus Ferguson from the late 1890s. But can you share with us some of the others?
The clearest example, most recent example, would be Bush versus Gore. Here's a case in which many lawyers at the time were actually dumbfounded that the Supreme Court of the United States even got into that case. You'll recall that's the case in which the Supreme Court made a ruling which essentially stopped the recount in Florida in the disputed election of 2000, Gore versus Bush. Many lawyers were dumbfounded that the Supreme Court even got into that controversy. They were even more dumbfounded in the way in which the Supreme Court resolved that controversy. That was clearly, and then the breakdown of the judges. I mean, we know that the conservative justices went one way. The more liberal, first of all, we don't really have hardly any real strong liberals on the Supreme Court at all, but we do have some that are more liberal than the most conservative ones. There was a clear ideological alignment. And one could see that in Bush versus Gore, and one can see that in many cases. You give me a controversial case involving one of these, you know, hot-button political or social issues, and I can tell you what the lineup is generally going to be.
Let's talk about the role of Justice Clarence Thomas and the persistence of the color line, how that blends from your perspective.
Well, of course, this is the 20th year that he has been on the Supreme Court, and, you know, his career, it seems to me, is a good illustration of what I was just talking about. His sponsors were politicians on the right. He said during his confirmation hearings that, you know, he has no agenda, that he's stripped down, that he only does things according to the law. It's not his will, it's not his beliefs, it's something outside of himself that prompts him to, you know, rule one way or another. Well, we have 20 years of his rulings, and there's nothing surprising about what he has done. One knows from the get-go how he's going to vote, and, you know, he is a politician in black robes. Now, frankly, all of the justices are politicians in black robes, and sometimes the public has been buffaloed into believing something else. The justices say that they're doing something else, but they're either lying or they are engaged in self-delusion, because the Supreme Court of the United States is a sector of our government. It's a powerful sector of our government, and the ideological beliefs of the justices come through in what they do. And as far as Justice Thomas is concerned, he is a right-wing politician, and he has behaved for the past 20 years like a right-wing politician. So if you're, you know, right-wing, you're happy with what Justice Thomas has done. If you're not, you're not happy with what he's done.
Well, he was challenged in the October 23rd editorial in the New York Times, which ends that Justice Thomas has spent 20 years advancing a judicial philosophy that rejects restraint in decision-making and fidelity to legal precedent. His disregard for essential principles has surely added to public cynicism about how Supreme Court law is made.
The most important thing in the sentences that you just read had to do with the question of public sentiment. Unfortunately, the public is not nearly as attentive as it should be to the Supreme Court and to the judiciary in general. I mean, I think, unfortunately, that the legal system has pulled the wool over the eyes of the public. Take a look at our confirmation hearings. I mean, the confirmation hearings are ridiculous. The justices, all of them, are engaged in evasion, if not worse. They're expected to. It's one big charade. In fact, if a person answers questions like they ought to answer questions, they are viewed as being actually foolish. And what is viewed as being prudent is evasion.
You call the hearings a ridiculous sham in your book. How should they be?
Well, in my view, justices should be asked questions. What's your constitutional vision? And they should have to answer. I mean, why should it be that the public has to sort of put such trust in somebody behind a black curtain of uncertainty? I think the senators should ask questions and demand answers. And if answers aren't forthcoming, I think that senators should actually hold candidates for the judiciary accountable.
Do you think that change will come about?
No, no time soon. In the last couple of confirmation hearings, there have been a number of senators. For instance, Senator Specter, with Elena Kagan, voiced his frustration with the dance that is played. Justices are asked questions. They answer what they want to answer. So, for instance, if you ask a justice, well, what do you think about Brown versus Board of Education? All of them will answer that question. They'll say, oh, you know, well, I embrace Brown versus Board of Education, or I embrace Marbury versus Madison, or I detest Dred Scott or Plessy. They'll say those things. But then if you ask them, well, what do you think of Roe versus Wade? Oh, I can't answer that question, because issues related to Roe versus Wade might come up before the Supreme Court. Well, frankly, issues involving all of those cases are always coming up before the Supreme Court. But when they feel that they can answer a question without, you know, putting themselves in jeopardy, they answer it. If they think that it'll be inconvenient to answer a question, they don't. And it's for that reason that it seems to me that the confirmation hearings are a charade.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Professor Randall Kennedy, who teaches at Harvard Law School in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and is the author of a recent book, The Persistence of the Color Line, Racial Politics and the Obama Presidency. Randall Kennedy is also the author of Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word. Professor Kennedy, let's move on to the 2012 election. And I'd like to ask you to interpret the comments of the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who said last summer that his goal is to defeat President Obama.
In one manner of speaking, that should not be surprising. You know, that's just the way it is. At the same time, I do think it's the case that the level of reaction, the intensity of reaction, some of the allegations that have been made about Barack Obama do have a racial basis. I am not saying that the only reason people are against Barack Obama is because of race. I am not saying that. There are people who are against Barack Obama for religious reasons, for ideological reasons, for reasons of partisanship. But there are some people, an appreciable number of people, who are against him, at least in part, because he's a black man. And people like Senator McConnell should recognize that. They're not saying anything about that, but that's part of the reaction against Obama. Sometimes people don't say it, you know, openly. They don't say, I'm against him because he's black. So what do they do? Sometimes they say, oh, I'm against him because I think he's a Muslim, as if that were a decent reason for being against someone, which of course it is not. Or they will say, oh, I'm against him because I don't think he was born in the United States. Because, of course, according to the Constitution of the United States, to be president, you have to have been a native-born citizen of the United States. A bad provision of the Constitution, in my view, but that's another story. So sometimes people will say that they're against Obama for non-racial reasons, but actually, if you really talk with them a whole lot, it becomes clear that race is the real reason.
Let's move on to your observations about the candidacy of Herman Cain for the Republican nomination.
Well, I think the McCain candidacy, and right now, I mean, he's in the top tier of the Republican candidates, shows a couple of things. One, his ascendancy in Republican circles shows, like the election of Barack Obama, that there's been a considerable change in racial attitudes in America. There's no question about that. You know, in 1958, the Gallup organization asked white Americans, would you be willing to vote for a black person if that person were, A, qualified, and B, if that person was the nominee of your own party? In 1958, 3 out of 5 white Americans said no. Even under those circumstances, they would not be willing to vote for a black person as president. That number had dwindled to less than 1 in 10 by the 1990s. So there's been a lot of change in terms of racial attitudes. Here is Herman Cain, the darling of the Republican right wing, at least momentarily. That shows considerable change. At the same time, we still have the persistence of the color line, because Herman Cain, like Barack Obama, has to confront the color line. With respect to Herman Cain's right wing allies, when his colleague, the governor of Texas, was criticized because of that ranch with the name Niggerhead, Herman Cain said, well, you know, I found that to be, you know, insensitive. He was immediately attacked. People accused him, you know, former allies accused him of playing the race card. And what did he do? He had to very quickly back up off of that. Very quickly. He has to confront, you know, the race line, just like all black people has to confront the race line. It's still very much with us, even in the midst of considerable change.
Can you share with us how you personally have confronted the race line as a professor at Harvard Law School?
Sure. I'm very privileged. I've been at Harvard Law School for 27 years. It's a wonderful place. It's a wonderful working environment. But on the very first day, I'm quite sure that, well, you know, when class begins and I go down front and I begin the class, I know that there are students of all sorts, not just white students, but, you know, all the students are wondering to themselves, you know, is this a real Harvard law professor that I have, or is this person something less? I mean, I'm sure that's, you know, in the consciousness of the students. And that's because of, you know, the racial moment that we occupy. Again, the fact that I'm at the front of the class shows change. I would not have been at the front of the class, or nobody like me would have been at the front of the class 60 years ago. But the fact that I'm black, the fact that that's sort of in the air and part of the calculations that students are making, you know, there we have the persistence of the color line, even to this day, even at Harvard Law School.
Well, Professor Randy Kennedy, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about a eureka or an aha moment that has changed your life or that you still carry closely with you?
Yes, I suppose that my eureka moment was a very tragic one, and that's when my wonderful wife passed away 5 years ago, which really transformed my life and has had a very big influence on the way I view life.
Can you share with us the influence that it's had on how you view life?
Sure. I mean, it has brought home to me the uncertainty of life. The next day is not promised to us. I say as often as I can to people whom I love that I love them and that I'm grateful for what they do, because one never knows when a person whom you love will be taken from you. So it's definitely had a big influence on me.
So with that influence in mind, what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
There are two things. I have two big missions. First is be a good father for my three children. That's really mission number one and way above anything else. The second is to continue to write about subjects that interest me. Write articles, write books.
Do you have any in the works now?
Oh, sure. I've got a bunch. One book I'm doing is a book on affirmative action. The big book that I'm doing is going to be a book just called Race Relations Law in the United States, 1776 to the present. And that'll try to bring together all that I've tried to do over the past quarter century.
And finally, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, a very interesting book that's just came out is a book called Body and Soul, The Black Panther Party and the Fight Against Medical Discrimination. It's by a professor of sociology at Columbia University, Alondra Nelson. I'm reading that and finding it to be very interesting, very illuminating.
Professor Randall Kennedy from the Harvard Law School, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you very much for having me. Take care.
Randall Kennedy is a professor of law at Harvard University Law School. He is the author of The Persistence of the Color Line, Racial Politics and the Obama Presidency. This interview was recorded on October 28, 2011. The book that he recommends is Body and Soul, The Black Panther Party and the Fight Against Medical Discrimination by Alondra Nelson. Interviews with Professor Kennedy about his earlier books, Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word, and Interracial Intimacies, Sex, Marriage, Identity, and Adoption may be heard on the Radio Curious website. All Radio Curious programs are free at our website, radiocurious.org. Our phone is 707-462-6541. Email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onestad is our associate producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.